You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Elon.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you in Washington, I gather? You're in D.C.?
Yeah, I'm in D.C. hanging out. It's been an interesting week, but I'm doing all right.
It's been a lot of interesting weeks since January of 2017.
Yeah, I feel like they don't stop.
No. So let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via audio podcast. You are Elon Goldenberg. You were a Pentagon official during the Obama administration, I guess. More specifically, you were head of the Iran team in the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And you are now director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for New American Security there in Washington, a think tank. And we are going to talk about Iran. You wrote a piece recently for Foreign Affairs called What a War with Iran Would Look Like. We're going to talk about what a war would look like and some other things you've been considering lately, like is there a way to wind the whole thing down a little and put relations with Iran on a better footing and perhaps end the current U.S. policy of economic strangulation of Iran, which I think some Iranians would welcome. So let's start out. Now, you wrote this piece before the shoot down of the drone, but after the sabotaging of the tankers, which came in two rounds, May and June. I think your view is that, that pretty clearly the Iranians were responsible for both of those sets of attacks. Some people are, the evidence is circumstantial, and so some people are withholding judgment. But in any event, let's talk before we get into what you said in your piece. Let's pick up the story where Trump was about to retaliate for the drone Iranian shooting down the drone, which they by their own account did. The question is only whether it was over international waters or Iranian waters. Trump was poised to launch retaliatory strikes. There was a likelihood that some Iranians would die. How do you think the Iranians, let's say 10 or 20 Iranians had died, how do you think Iran might have responded? What are some plausible ways they might have responded?
Sure. So I think where you would probably see is it partially depends, and this is why one of the things I've encouraged us to do and for the U.S. to think about is, look, if you want to retaliate, you can do so quietly in a way that doesn't force Iran's hand. This, I think, is a key component. So if you very publicly come out and announce we're going to do these strikes and then you do these strikes and you kill Iranians, you put Iranian leadership in a position where they feel they have to respond politically. So how do they respond? Maybe they respond by blowing up more tankers. But this time, the tankers that they did hit, they were pretty careful about leaving the mines at a certain place on the ship where it would do not that much damage. You could actually hit lower down, in which case you would actually cause a much bigger oil leak and potentially faster sinking of these ships, more fatalities. You could see attacks on Americans in Iraq. That would be a very clear way for them to retaliate using some of their proxy groups. Those would seem to be, or you could see them, launching at targets in the UAE or Saudi Arabia or something like that. They have all these different ways to respond. But if you were, for example, to make something go boom in Iran, like one of these anti-air, air defense systems that shot down the drone, without actually acknowledging it, and without sort of saying who it was, then privately send the Iranians a message and say, it was us. We're about to get into a real conflict here. Back off. I think the Iranians would listen to that message and wouldn't feel the need to respond. And you could de-escalate in that way.
Well, it's not like Trump to do that, I must say.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like Trump, given an opportunity to be at center stage, to not be at center stage, right?
Yeah.
And also it's not like Bolton. It's not like this administration. You know, what you're describing is something Israel does a lot, right?
Exactly.
But but the U.S. under this administration, it's not that easy to imagine doing it. Now, a couple of things. First of all, you talked about the variety of ways Iran could respond. I want to read a paragraph from your piece. The Islamic Republic can use proxy forces in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen to attack the U.S. and its partners. It has an arsenal of ballistic missiles that can target U.S. bases in Iran, Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. Its mines and land-based anti-ship missiles can wreak havoc in the Strait of Hormuz and drive up global oil prices. Iran has the capacity to shut down a significant portion of Saudi oil production and with aggressive sabotage or cyber attacks, and with its paramilitary unit known as the Quds Force, Iran can attack U.S. targets around the globe. Sounds like a lot. For starters, is it pretty clear that Iran has the ability to push all of those buttons? I mean, I think, you know, there are these so-called proxy forces, and I think one problem with that description is there's sometimes a tendency to attribute everything any one of those proxy forces does to Iran. And you'd probably agree that that's not a sound inference.
Nope.
They do proceed with autonomy. These groups have their own interests. The Houthi rebels, I mean, first of all, they didn't start out as some kind of proxy. They're rebels, and they have their own cause, and so but leaving that aside, leaving aside the fact that not everything these forces do is done at the direction of Iran, does Iran have the capacity to activate all of the actors you list?
Not probably all at the same time. Like, I don't think that they would do this all at the same time unless we were going to the point of all out war. Right. I mean, first of all, you would have this slow escalation. We do something, they respond, we respond, they respond. Maybe eventually things get out of control. We can go into how that happens. But, you know, in terms of the proxy forces, they have different relationships for different levels. So a group like Hezbollah, who they've been developing for 30 years, has some of its own independent political interests in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. But if the U.S. and Iran get into a major conflict and Iran asks Hezbollah to start launching missiles at Israel, it will be very hard for Hezbollah to say no. Mm-hmm. Compare that on the other end of the spectrum. You've got the Taliban, who Iran has on occasion worked with or helped out. There's nothing strategic there. There's very little control. There's no control. I mean, Iran has also almost gotten into a war with the Taliban in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. You know, and the Houthis are somewhere in the middle. The Houthis are not going to take military strategy from the Iranians in terms of, hey, attack this place in Yemen, don't attack that place in Yemen. But the Iranians have given them a bunch of missiles and UAVs and things like that. And there I can see if the Iranians say, hey, can you take this sophisticated thing we gave you and we have our own trainers on the ground and target Saudi Arabia with it? I can see the Houthis saying, yeah, you know, so I think there's like this range of what they can do. And also, I mean, even, you know, for example, attacks on U.S. Embassies, that's very hard to pull off. They did successfully target a couple of things in Argentina in the early 90s. They have done these, but they also have, you know, really screwed these types of operations up. They had a plot to try to bomb Cafe Milano in 2012 in Washington, D.C., and it was just total amateur hour. So, you know, so I don't think all these things would happen. I think some of them would happen.
Was it ever even super clear what was going on with that? That always seemed to me a little weird. I mean, that didn't seem like the kind of thing that had come from the top of the Iranian hierarchy. It was just too weird in too many ways. Yeah. It starts out with this. Well, I won't get into it, but it was an abort. It was. Yeah. Anyway.
No, I agree with you. And I was in the government, the U.S. government at the time. And I first heard these stories. I was like, this is bananas. This doesn't make sense. But then once you actually saw the information, I think there's, so, you know, there's all these different channels inside of Iran who are working with the supreme leader, and some of them are utterly reasonable. You know, a guy like Rouhani or Zarif, like, there's no way those guys would support something like that.
Okay. That's the elected president and his foreign minister. And Iran has this complicated system where the supreme leader is the supreme leader, and he's not popularly elected. He's elected by a small council. Yeah. But then there's the government that, although they're not the supreme leaders, they have a real kind of power. The regular military, I gather, reports to the president, then the Revolutionary Guard, the supreme leader, kind of. It's a weird system,
exactly.
And it makes it hard to figure out where stuff is coming from sometimes.
Yeah, I think it does. I do think that the bottom line is, there's two things I say about the Iranian system. One, when everybody agrees, the Supreme Leader goes along with it, even if he's not sure. So, for example, everyone agreed they needed to get into the negotiations with the United States and ultimately support the JCPOA. That's one of the reasons the Supreme Leader went along with it. But then there's real disagreements sometime in the system, in which case the Supreme Leader becomes kind of the decision maker or the tiebreaker. And he doesn't understand this very well. And he is, you know, sometimes reasonable and listens to somebody like, you know, the Foreign Minister Zarif, who understands this much better. And sometimes he listens to some of these guys in the Revolutionary Guard who really don't understand this at all and have some intense conspiracy theories and paranoia about the U.S. And that's when you end up with some of these wacky plots or things.
Can't imagine why they would have. Can't imagine exactly. Why they think the U.S. is out to get them. Gosh.
So,
I just want to briefly touch on that. I mean, people, I think, don't realize that, I mean, going back to when we supported a coup that unseated democratically elected government in the early 50s, mm-hmm. ushered in brutal repression. Moreover, we pretty much sided with Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war. Iraq had invaded Iran. That is a trauma for, I don't know if tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of Iranians were killed. Chemical weapons were used. And the U.S. was on Iraq's side. And this is all, and so like, you know, I mean, one of the grievances of Pompeo and so on is they have killed U.S. soldiers. Well, given that history, when we invade Iraq and move a huge force into Iraq, if I'm Iran, I'm definitely going to try to get them the hell out of Iraq.
Yeah, there's definitely, look, there is a perfectly rational, totally reasonable defensive reason for why they do a lot of the things they do. And based on exactly the history you described. And then there's also an offensive reason, which is they'd like to have more influence in the region, and push back on some of the other players. And so, you know, and so those are the dual motivations. And I'm quite sympathetic to the defensive motivations and I understand where they come from. I'm much less sympathetic to, you know, some of the offensive motivations. For example, I mean, they're messing around in Yemen. They're doing that basically to mess with the Saudis. There's really no reason to do it, but they're making a civil war worse. I don't see a reason for them to be doing it and supporting, you know. So
I actually want to have this discussion because I think I disagree with you about some of this stuff, but let's leave people on the edge of their seats and promise this showdown to come closer toward the end. And just, I think I took us kind of off track, but back to the way war unfolds, you mentioned that in your piece, and I think just now you use the term save face, or you know, Iran would have, to the extent that the U.S. attack is public, Iran would have to save face. Now, I gather you mean both on the international stage and in terms of their domestic politics, showing their people that they're not to be trifled with?
Yeah, I think it's both of those. And it's more than just save face. It's also There's this disagreement inside of Iran on like what to do and how to deal with the U.S. For the last year, you know, there's been some saying, look, we should play it slow. We should isolate the U.S. from its partners. We should stay in the nuclear deal. And there have been others who are saying the only thing the Americans understand is force and pushback. And I think that argument, especially if the U.S. hits Iran, probably wins the day inside that system, you know, and then the response is we have to demonstrate that we won't be pushed around. So it's partially saving face and it's partially saying to us, the United States, we need to deter you. And so then they hit back in order to deter us and we hit back to try to send a signal to them. You know, you're sort of going up quickly. You're saying we're going to hit back and then we're going to negotiate. And then they say, okay, we'll hit back and then we'll negotiate the escalate. Nobody wants a conflict, but everybody is trying to sort of get the upper hand or signal the other side to stop. And in the process, they inadvertently walk themselves into a conflict.
Some people in the Trump administration may actually want a conflict.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Bolton in particular.
So given that, don't you think that if Trump launches a strike that kills Iranians, they basically have to then kill some Americans? I mean, given the politics of the situation, that's what you would expect, right?
I think that would be the most likely scenario, yes. They would find a way. They would need to do something that they think sends a signal to us, and be able to own it. So
And yeah, but again, you know, I want to pause it, send a signal to us, because the reason I brought up their domestic politics is I think a very common thing in especially American media analysis of this and analysis by experts is to adopt the enemy's point of view in terms of geostrategy.
Yeah.
But not appreciate the domestic political pressures. And and I think one reason is any country we call authoritarian, we think doesn't have to be responsive to its people. Whereas, in fact, even I mean, dictators are the most fearful in a way of their public pressure. So I just I want to just emphasize that I would think that a certain amount of the pressure is domestic. And if we kill Iranians as a matter of politics, they pretty much have to kill some Americans. I mean, especially given the fact that we're subjecting them to economic strangulation right now.
Yeah, I think you'd probably, especially since you'd probably have these big public funerals, you know, and celebrate these people's martyrs. And that would only generate more of that kind of domestic political pressure. Absolutely. And so, you know, they find a way to hit us. We find a way to hit them. And the other thing that happens, and I think this is really important while all this is happening, you have the domestic political pressure on both sides. You have both sides trying to send signals short of going all out. But then you also have both sides starting to take steps that are, that they view as defensive, that the other side will view as offensive. This is like classic security dilemma. So we, for example, the way we fight, we will bring a whole bunch of assets into the Middle East. We, you know, we'll rush an aircraft carrier in there. We'll do, you know, bring in more fighters, more, all kinds of things. The Iranians will see that. We'll be doing it, not necessarily because we want to go to war, but because we want to be ready to defend ourselves. But how will Iran see that? They will see that as, hey, the Americans are getting ready to like hit us with everything they got. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the Iranians will do something that's in their doctrine, which is they have all these missiles and mines that they have in centralized locations, right? Like basically storage depots. So what they're going to do is that those are really easy to hit if they're just in one spot. So what do? You disperse them. You put your mines on small ships. You take your missiles and you disperse them to all kinds of different launch sites. It's a lot harder to destroy them all. So we see that and we're like, well, they're about to hit us and we're going to be a lot more vulnerable. So at that point, both sides are looking at the other side saying, hey, they're getting ready to hit us with everything they got. Maybe we should hit them first.
Right.
And that's when you start to, that's when things really start to get out of control.
Right. And in fact, what in a way started a certain amount of this is when Iran apparently put some missiles on small boats and sent the boats out. That could be a way of dispersing the missiles. In any event, there are various ways it could be. You could imagine it's defensive. Anyway, then Bolton like announced we're sending, you know, a bunch of hardware there. And then, and it's right after that, I think that the first round of tanker sabotage happened, right?
Yeah. Pretty much simultaneous. Yeah.
Was it simultaneous? Or, I mean, that Bolton, but Bolton didn't, had that happened when Bolton sent the hardware?
It happened about a day or two afterwards. But
see, that's what I mean. Yeah. Because I saw that as a signal. Of the two rounds of tanker attacks, that's the one I see as more plausibly Iranian, because that makes sense as a signal. It's like you can send your aircraft carriers here if you want, but understand we can put a lot of, you know, mischief in these waters. That made sense to me as a signal.
Yeah, so look, let me just tell you like why I think this was almost definitely Iranian, because I think this is important. First of all, they've been saying they're going to do this. They have the capability to do it. They've done it in the past. But more importantly, I don't think, and you know, some of these false flag ideas that are out there, I just don't think they're plausible, because I don't think any of the actors are competent enough to do this and keep it secret. The Saudis and the Emiratis, for example, they actually launched a false flag attack on Qatar 2 years ago. When they started the big, you know, GCC rift, they did a cyber attack. They went into Qatari websites and they put all kinds of stuff up that was pro-Iranian and pro Al-Qaeda. And it was so ham-handed. Everybody saw right through it in about a second.
Well, maybe they learned from that.
Maybe, but they also have been very quiet in their response. So the first four bombs were dropped.
You can read that two ways, but go ahead.
They were dropped in Fujairah, right? And the Emiratis have been the ones leading the investigation. And they've publicly come out and said a state actor did it, but they refused to even use the word Iran. I was actually there last week. They are very nervous about a war. They love the maximum pressure strategy. They are very happy to put all the sanctions on Iran and contain them. They don't realize, you know, but they don't want a war. They don't realize that this is triggering a war and you can't do this. Right. They want to have their cake and eat it too. And then we, the United States, I mean, this clown show, they cannot keep anything secret. If we were the ones who were launched something like this, we'd have military and intelligence officials would have to be part of it. They'd be talking to the New York Times in about 30 seconds.
Oh, I don't imagine the U.S. launched a false flag operation. But I do think, in terms of people who are reckless enough to do it, I mean, obviously Mohammed bin Salman, for him, it's just another day at work to do something risky. But anyway, I mean, whatever, it seems to me you could read it both ways. And again, the second set of tanker attacks seems a little weirder as an Iranian, but that aside, let's get back to the unfolding catastrophe. Sure. So the basic dynamic in the piece you wrote for Foreign Affairs is kind of what we've said. It's like once you start doing the tit for tat, and especially once it involves killing people, it's hard for one side to let the other side be the last one that killed somebody. Things get out of control. They escalate. And I guess the question is, how far can they escalate?
Well, I think that there comes a moment, right, where, look, at the end of the day, like, our military is much more capable than Iran's military. So there comes a moment as we're sort of going tit for tat, where the U.S. military comes to the president and says, look, we're vulnerable. This isn't to our advantage. We should just take a couple weeks and destroy as much of Iran's military infrastructure as we possibly can and really set them back. So let's sink their navy. Let's destroy as much of sort of their training camps and support for proxies, where they're doing these types of training, or smuggling routes. You can target the nuclear program. You can target all the missiles that they have. You can do a lot of damage. But now you're starting to look at something that looks a lot more like Gulf War I than like a pinpoint strike like you saw we did to Bashar al-Assad in 2017 or 18. And I think in that scenario, things get very bad for Iran, worse for them than for us. But that's the scenario where all those things we talked about, they'll just sort of release everything they got, So they'll start to try to drop mines in the Straits. They will drive oil prices to 150. They'll try to get Hezbollah, and I think probably successfully get Hezbollah to start launching missiles at Israel, which could lead to a conflict there. They will launch missiles at bases all over the Gulf. They'll try to sink American ships. They'll try to attack Americans. And a lot of this stuff won't be successful. Their missiles aren't the most accurate. Some of their proxies might not listen to them. But they will do a good bit of damage, too. I mean, they got a lot of tools. And so,
like, how many Americans could they kill in the Gulf area?
If they wanted to, they could.
I mean, in terms of things that would get U.S. attention, they could kill dozens of soldiers in Iraq, right?
Yes. Or Syria. They can go after in Syria. They could go after us in Afghanistan. They could go after our ships. In the Gulf, they could also start launching, a lot of missiles. The missiles aren't that accurate, but if you launch enough, you're going to hit something. They could start launching at cities, right? They could start launching at Riyadh or Abu Dhabi or Dubai, these big, cities in the Gulf with a lot of people and a lot of critical infrastructure. They also have cyber capabilities. They could start going after the global oil supply. They could start going after water facilities, desalination plants, which is actually something that the Houthis launched a sort of failed strike on a couple weeks ago, which in many ways made the Gulf much more nervous. I think the reality is, like, we all lose. It's terrible for everybody. It's worse for them, but the problem is we're even after you do this, you're kind of stuck there now. All these ideas, we're going to pull back from the Middle East, we're going to pivot to Asia, we're going to fight great power competition, and all that's done. You're in the Middle East in a big way for a generation now, because you've got still a strong, big, angry Iran in the middle of that region. That's going to keep finding ways to target the United States and its partners for years.
Now, you don't imagine American boots on the ground in Iran in any scenario. Is that right?
No, there is a scenario where that happens. I think it's a stretch, though. I think that I'm less worried about that. But this is where what I do worry about is, and it's kind of like the Libya scenario, right? when you get to this point now where you've gone so far and they have exacted so much damage and things have gotten so ugly. In the case of Libya, it was a little different because they weren't really, you know, Gaddafi wasn't exacting damage on us, but it started as a mission that was all about, you know, protecting civilians, and it evolved into regime change because it almost just naturally did. And you can see that. You can see political pressure. They kill a bunch of Americans. They get some lucky hits. They sink an American ship. And you can see the pressure in Washington starting to build for, you know, well, we might as well just go all the way. That would be insane. Iran is a country with a population three times the size of Iraq. Mm-hmm. The topography is worse. It's also a more unified country. It doesn't have a lot of the same sort of ethnic splits that Iraq does. It would be, I mean, to me, unfathomable. But, you know, if once you just don't know, once you're sort of that, when things are that out of control, you just don't know.
You have, yeah. You know, you have a couple of influential people in the administration who want regime change, Bolton and Pompeo. I guess that's in order of the intensity of their aspiration, maybe, but, so you can see that. Another scenario I've wondered about in the long run is if, you know, the context of this would not be, at least to any rational person, we think they're secretly developing a nuclear weapon somewhere.
Yeah.
But that said, if you did, or if you wanted to use that, it's probably a fact that if you want to be, you know, if you conjure up that scenario where somewhere they're secretly working on a nuclear weapon, that becomes a rationale for putting American boots on the ground, right? Because if it's secret, or if it's, you know, a bunch of dispersed facilities or something, we'll just have to inspect every building or something. I don't know.
Yeah, you can see that too. You know, I'm skeptical that they're doing that, and I don't, but it could be.
Oh, so am I, but I'm not skeptical that some people in the White House would
use that
as a pretext.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. I mean, that's one thing. The other thing, the White House guys seem to have this idea that you can just collapse Iran from the inside, right? So we won't have to invade. We're just going to do all this. Then we're going to keep them in a box and keep squeezing them. But, you know, I mean, look, we've seen the results of the Arab Spring, right? When countries implode from the inside out, the answer is not democracy. It's violence, terrorism, large amounts of refugees. Iran's population is the same population and size combined of Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria altogether. Mm-hmm. Like, so if we actually get the collapse scenario, which guys like Mark Dubowitz seem to like not mind and push for, I mean, be careful what you wish for.
He's at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which is a kind of ardently anti-Iran think tank. And if you Google it and Slate, you can read John Judas's illuminating account. Go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry. Yes. But yeah, it's, you know, so there's this whole thread out there. People think you don't have to invade. You just do this small fight and then Iran collapses from within and democracy just arises. That's probably not how this goes.
So you think, I mean, two questions about sustained military assault by the U.S. Do you think there are people in the White House who think that alone could bring regime change, A, or maybe that with minimal covert manipulation, you know, we send, you know, the equivalent of Ahmad Jalabi or whatever, but and B, do you think there's any chance of that? Or do you think there's much chance that you would get regime change through that avenue?
So I do think there's people in the White House who probably believe that because we saw much less stuff happening, just some of the protests over the last couple of years. And every time the protests happen, the White House gets super excited and seems to think like, this is it. Right. You know, not really understanding Iranian society at all. You know, I think if you were to have a collapse or shift in regime in Iran, the most likely scenario is an IRGC takeover. You know, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, basically a military takeover from the clerics, which would really not be much of a change at all.
That's not our goal, as I understand.
Right, exactly. But it's, you know, the best comparison you can draw to any of the Arab Spring countries is Egypt, right? Which was, it's a society with a long history, strong sense of nationalism, pretty unified, where the strongest institution is the military. And so if things start to collapse, who takes over? that's who the natural sort of, you know, it's less likely that you're going to have civil war because you don't have, you know, Sunni Shia divides, things like that, like Kurdish. You have some of that, but not nearly at the same levels like Iraq or Syria. It's much more like Egypt. So I think that's by far the most likely scenario of where things go.
So one question is, is there a path by which this is resolved? By resolved, I don't mean just not going to war and avoiding war in the short run. I mean getting things back on any kind of healthy track with Iran. I mean, the Trump administration's definition of that would be like bring them to the negotiating table. I think Trump himself certainly, and maybe all the people in the White House, are gravely confused as what Iran would and would not be willing to do at the negotiating table. But in the shorter term, kind of like, there's just the fact that, you know, Iran is now suffering greatly economically because of the sanctions. We've reduced their oil imports massively. And I don't know where you go from. I mean, I keep having this fantasy that like the Europeans will get some steel in their spines and maybe just actually confront Trump. And I don't think, I really think the world doesn't totally understand yet that Trump will back down under a lot of circumstances. And I don't know what would happen if like France and Germany even, you know, kind of got together with China and Russia and said, we're going to, you know, it's okay to import oil from Iran. You know, no, we just can't, you know, this is crazy what's going on, and just blatantly defied the sanctions. I get there must be reasons you understand that I don't, that just can't happen. But if that doesn't happen, I mean, like, what's the scenario? What's the positive scenario?
So, yeah, I mean, the reason that can't happen, I think the governments would even be willing to do some of that, and they've tried. But the problem is, it's the private sectors in these countries, it's the companies in these countries that ultimately are the ones that have to invest in Iran. And they're totally tied into the American financial system, and they basically have a choice. Invest in Iran and lose access to the U.S. market, or invest in the U.S., and all of them are petrified to lose the U.S. market. So,
what U.S. Market in the sense of that mechanisms that are already in place would automatically hurt them, or that Trump would announce some retaliatory tariff or what?
No, mechanisms, the sanctions that are already in place would hurt them and basically cut them off from the American banking system.
From the banking
system. Which would then make it impossible for them to do business globally, because the dollar is still the universal currency. So so you wouldn't be able to transact in dollars.
So the problem is the incentive of companies, not governments so much.
Yes, exactly. And the governments, if anything, I mean, they're deeply frustrated with how this has gone. And they're talking about longer term. It's not going to matter in the Iran case, but longer term, you know, a lot of our European partners are talking about how to develop some economic independence from the United States so that the U.S. can't do what it's doing, basically dictate things to them this way. They're deeply frustrated, but there's really, they've been trying. I'm pretty sympathetic for that to them. I spend a lot of time talking to them, and they try their best, but they're in an impossible spot between Trump, who's yelling at them constantly to do more, and the Iranians, who feel genuinely frustrated that, you know, they can't do anything for them.
Now, China is buying some oil from Iran, I guess. Yeah. Is that the government buying it or the?
So China, because its economy is so big and it has some of these smaller oil companies that aren't tied to the American system at all, is able to go around that. The Europeans are much more tied. I mean, the Chinese are pretty tied into the American system too. The big Chinese companies are doing nothing with Iran. But some of the smaller ones are capable of.
But like,
of
I mean, if
this.
You wanted to, couldn't some European billionaire or government or something just create a new company, you know?
Yeah.
And what it does is import oil from Iran and then it sells it. And it's like, and that's all it does. Why not do that?
It's an interesting question. I think it would be a financial loser because they wouldn't be able to sell to anybody.
Oh, I see the secondary. So they have to sell it on the black market, or else the buyers would themselves be punished by the. Oh God, I mean, is it? Don't you think America's? I think it's just fair to call it out and out abuse of its role. Its central role in the financial system is going to come back to haunt us. I mean, we're going to lose control precisely because we abuse it, right? I mean, Europe is working on some for now, piddling little alternative financial mechanism. But
yeah,
it is reasonable to expect that that's going to evolve into a genuine rival, right? Or something, something will.
I think that depends. I think they'll definitely try. The question is whether they can come up with anything that actually works. But it's a long-term type of trend. Yes, I think you're right. This, the over-reliance on sanctions will eventually make sanctions less effective because people will look for tools to avoid it and look for ways to, you know, not just go along. You know, basically the way the Europeans talk about it is economic sovereignty. Like they have to be able to control their own global economic policy. And right now they're just being browbeaten by us.
Right. And it's just to just pause and appreciate how crazy it must seem to them. They arduously negotiated a really not bad deal with Iran that left everyone reassured that for years and years, you're not going to see nuclear weapons. There were really intrusive monitoring. And as part of the deal, I think the Iranians were going to sign. I mean, they're members, you know, of the non-proliferation treaty. They were going to sign what's called the additional protocol, which is an agreement that they're exposed to certain kinds of inspections, even when the terms of this deal expire and so on. Looking damn good. Trump is the one who abandons the deal and starts, in effect, violating its terms and decides that Iran is the one who should be punished for that. And any country that doesn't join in the punishment, we will punish.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just like words fail.
It's even better than that because story that's just amazing that makes it even like worse. For 6 months before Trump walked away from the nuclear deal, he basically got the Europeans into a negotiation of how to make amendments to the deal or look for a follow-on deal that will improve it and address his concerns. So the Europeans went through this whole kabuki dance with the Trump administration to try to convince them to stay in the deal. And the negotiations on the U.S. side were led by Brian Hook, who's the special envoy, you know, sort of for dealing with all Iran issues at the State Department. Emmanuel Macron, the French president, came to Washington right before Trump walked away from the nuclear deal. He was the European leader with the best relationship with Trump. He came to try to convince Trump to stay in. In the meeting, he referenced Brian Hook to Trump. Trump looked at him and said, "Who's Brian Hook?" So you're just like
the guy you just appointed, you know.
The Europeans are pretty frustrated at that moment, I think.
Yeah. That's funny. I mean, sad, funny. So, what is the scenario by which, for the remainder of Trump's presidency, anything happens other than Iran's economy collapsing, and then come what may?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for the next 18 months, we're in essentially this tit for tat game that we have to hope doesn't explode, because ultimately, the good news is, you know, we talked about all the reasons of what might drive it up. But the good news is that neither side wants a war ultimately. They want to poke each other. Iranians are trying to poke us to say, like, there's costs to you too if you keep squeezing us. But they're trying to – they purposely have not killed Americans, right? Because they hear Trump and Pompeo and these guys saying American deaths would be a clear red line for us. So they keep doing things like this. We keep responding in different ways. Everybody kind of avoids a conflict. And then – I think then you have the 2020 elections in the United States, and that goes one of two ways. If Trump wins, the Iranians will have to find a way back to the negotiating table with him because they can't keep sustaining this economic pressure forever. And he does want to talk. He doesn't know what he wants to talk about. He doesn't know. And the Iranians don't want to go back to the table right now because they feel like they would be rewarding him for walking away from the nuclear deal. They are very proud, and they feel like he's not showing them any respect whatsoever in the way he talks about them. And they don't have, you know, as opposed to North Korea, where Kim Jong-un got this just benefit of being on the stage with an American president, they've been on these stages for the last 5 years. They don't get that political benefit because they were there, you know, with the P5+1.
Well, I think I'd go further and say, isn't there a political cost they pay domestically if they're seen in public with the U.S. president at this moment? Yep.
Yeah. And in some ways, some of these things that they're doing, I think could be if we're smart enough to not respond too forcefully, give them a little more space domestically to be able to say, we were tough. we shot down an American drone. We blew up some of these tankers. We, you know, we did X, Y, or Z. Now that we're tough, we've moved the Americans back and we can go back into negotiations. So they will have to find a way if there's a second Trump term. If it's a Democrat in 2021, then I think you will go back into negotiations and diplomacy. The Iranians will be willing to do that. It will be hard at that point. I think, you know, all the Democratic candidates have said, we'll go back into the JCPOA. And I agree with that. For Democrats,
that's a nuclear deal, the JCPOA.
So first of all, the question is, will the nuclear deal still be there, or will Iran be so far out of it that it won't be possible to really go back in? Second, they've got their own presidential elections a few months after ours. So they're going to, and probably will be electing somebody who's more skeptical about negotiations with the United States. And like you said, it's not a democracy. These, you know, even all these presidential candidates have to be vetted by the supreme leader and his people before decisions can be made on who runs. So, but there is, once, as long as you're acceptable to the system, usually the election actually is within that.
And the outcome matters. I mean, in the sense that if Rouhani had not been elected president years ago, the Iran deal might never have happened. He was moderate, exactly. And the Iran deal happened.
And now, most likely the person who comes next, especially after all the last few years, is going to be harder line. And then the Iranians also, we're going to come in with an opening position that says, we like the nuclear deal, but, you know, we also have concerns. There's things we'd like to do better, you know, longer sort of sunset provisions, so certain limitations stay on longer. We want to talk about the regional issues. So we will say, we'll come in and we'll say, we want to do the nuclear deal plus, and Iran's opening position will be, you owe us for 3 years of walking away from the deal and pressuring us. And so we want to go back into the nuclear deal, and what else are you going to give us? And so it's not going to be that easy to just flip back the nuclear deal on January 21st, 2021. But at least I think hopefully we have channels of dialogue and can begin at that point to look at diplomacy again, and whether that's going to the JCPOA or something else.
And do you think the Iranian economy can survive for 18 months without imploding in a way that just fundamentally alters the political system?
That is a million-dollar question that I don't think any of us know the answer to. Mm-hmm. It depends on how far they drive oil sales down. I mean, oil sales are, you know, at the Iran can sell about 2.5 million barrels a day. It's where they were once the JCPOA is in place and before the sanctions, you know, kicked in a few years ago. Now they're at 1 million, and the Trump administration is trying to drive them down to zero. Most estimates from people who know more about this stuff than I do say, you know, the Trump administration could probably get them down to 200,000 to 400,000 barrels a day. That's like one tenth of what they're capable of selling, and how long can the economy sustain that? You know, but the Iran, I mean, like you said, you talked about the Iran-Iraq war. I mean, they lived with years of horrible conditions, especially when there's a rally around the flag effect. Right. So people can survive.
Which we are producing right now, right?
Absolutely. And so, you know, people and regimes can survive, you know, remarkable pressure, without imploding. You know, and you see it all over the world. And so, you know, I think that most likely the scenario, I tend to think the most likely scenario is they find a way to survive in a very rough environment. But who knows?
And then hope that Trump is not reelected. Now, and then just briefly back to the avoiding war part. I mean, one reason to be pessimistic on that front, it seems to me, well, kind of hinges on you in a way on your interpretation of the tanker thing. Now, as we said, the first set of tanker attacks, I see as plausibly Iranian in the sense that it was a perfect time to send a signal to the Trump administration about the folly of Trump sending a bunch of aircraft carriers to Iran. It made sense as that. But the second set of attacks, if that was Iranian, I think the interpretation has to be, we're sending a signal to like the Europeans and so on. We're suffocating economically. We're going to cause havoc until you find a way to relieve the suffering. That would be the message of that, right?
Yeah, and I think the second attack. So when I saw the first attack, I was like, "This is part of the same strategy they've been using for the last year, slowly trying to separate, being very careful, trying to separate the U.S. from its partners. it came a couple days after Rouhani's announcement that Iran would start to, you know, not comply with certain elements of the nuclear deal in 60 days. It all seemed very measured. The second attack came with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in Iran. The first time a Japanese Prime Minister was in Iran in 40 years. And to me, that was pretty shocking. Because
one of the tankers was Japanese owned.
Yeah, and I don't know if that was on purpose or by mistake. You can't quite tell. But what's kind of shocking is that there's no way Rouhani or Zarif would have supported something like that. Those guys care a lot about Iran's international standing. For them, that's a big deal. That was part of the motivation of the nuclear deal. And this is a big visit for them. But the thing was, right after Abe finishes his meeting, the Supreme Leader is out there basically castigating him, putting out tweets that really embarrass Abe, in my opinion, say we won't negotiate with Japan, we won't negotiate with the United States. And so it felt to me like in this instance, the hardliners won the argument inside Tehran. The Supreme Leader knew what was going on, since everything that was choreographed and came with it was sort of similar. Zarif and Rouhani lost the argument. And that's worrying to me, because that says if the hardliners are starting to win the argument, then we're going to see more stuff that we can't predict. And well, also, they don't understand us.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I mean, the reason to be pessimistic is, is if this is part of a, you know, a coherent signaling strategy or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you're saying it was almost more intramural. It was an attack on the moderates in Iran as much as anything else. But if the kind of somewhat alternative explanation is true, A, if it was Iran, and B, if it was actually signaling to the world, we have to have economic relief. Well, there's not going to be any reason for those signals to end, right? Because the economy is going to get worse.
And I don't think it was. I think it was a signal to the world. It was partially about intramurals. It was partially a signal to the world. It was also a signal to the United States, because Abe was there at Trump's request. And so for them to do that, Trump had been in Tokyo a couple weeks before. So that was part of the message there, too. It was also a message to us, which was, you think you can negotiate with us while pushing us around? Like, that's not how we roll.
Now, we promised that we'd at least talk about this distinction between things Iran does defensively, things it does offensively, and you're having sympathy or understanding of the defensive things, less so the offensive. I guess I'm not so sure the line is so clear between the two, and B, as for the offensive stuff, it's not that I applaud it. I just don't see the difference between it and the kinds of, quote, offensive stuff that other players in the region do, including our allies, Saudi Arabia, Israel. And so, like, I mean, I understand one answer is, yeah, but they're our allies. Well, okay, if that's the way you want to describe it, I mean, I might raise questions as to whether it's an entirely wise choice of allies. But that aside, if you want to describe it that way, it's our team against their team. But the narrative in Washington, certainly from the White House and from the neocons, but I think to some extent sustained by the media, that no, Iran's just in another league. They do this crazy stuff. And I just don't think that's the case. I think they're another player in the Middle East jockeying for power. And if you were like observing this from Mars, you'd go, well, wonder who will win. They're all doing the same thing, right? Am I wrong about that?
So I think you're, it's complicated. Where do I fall in on that? That's because I'm sympathetic to both arguments, is I guess what I would say. There's certain things that they do, you know, they, for example, you know, had a couple of bombings foiled, one in Paris and one in, Copenhagen in the last 6 months that were being run by Iranian intelligence that were targeting, you know, big rallies, now rallies by opposition groups. Oh, sorry. I don't know.
That's okay. Dogs, we welcome dogs.
All right, you welcome dogs. I think our dog walker is here. So my dog is kind of excited about but anyway.
Sounds like a big dog.
He is. He's a part pit. You want me to, can I stop for a second and just go
if it's a
let
pit,
him out?
I think you should do whatever he says. You don't have to stop, but we can cut it out if it goes on for too long. But definitely tend to the demands of your pit.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He's a sweet dog. Well, hold on one sec. I'll be right back. Sorry about that.
That's okay. So you were saying, it sounds like you think there's pretty good intelligence that Iranian operatives were behind attempts to blow up some. Now, were those MEK rallies? I didn't know about these.
Yeah, the Paris one was an MEK rally.
Okay, so we should say MEK is this weird group of Iranians who were actually involved. It goes back to the revolution. Yeah. They were one of the revolutionary groups. But then they had a falling out with the regime that wound up dominating after the revolution. And they actually supported Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war. So they are not beloved. But the question I'd ask you is that qualitatively different? Okay, so they're, in other words, they're attacking basically, they see as their own domestic political enemies who are in another country at the time. Is that qualitatively different from Saudi Arabia killing Khashoggi when he's in Turkey? Is it qualitatively different? Is it, and how different is it from, I mean, in terms of just foreign operations that kill people, Israel, and perhaps with U.S. complicity, I'm not sure, but apparently Israel being responsible for the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists on Iranian soil. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not seeing a big, this is all terrorism to me, and I'm not seeing a big qualitative difference.
So, the Saudis took a huge amount of criticism for Khashoggi, and if we had a different American administration, would have, I think, suffered much more than they have. But I think in the long run, they will suffer significantly for that. I mean, I think Iranian nuclear scientists.
Israel, I would say, did not take that kind of heat for assassinating the various people it's assassinated in foreign countries.
I think that's true. I think that part of the problem with the Iranians is some of their actions, they're not as exact. It's not assassinations.
But you're not as good at terrorism as our allies are. Does not seem to me a compelling reason to depict them as this monstrous force in the Middle East, which is the way they're depicted in America.
But there's also a question of like the definition of terrorism, right? When you drop a bomb into a rally that kills 100 people versus, or like you sort of take out the Jewish, the Jewish center in Argentina in the early 90s.
I had heard from a very high ranking intelligence official that one reading of that is that it was Hezbollah retaliating for an Israeli assassination of somebody in Hezbollah. Mm. I don't approve it. God knows.
I'm just saying that
I thought there was still serious attention paid to the theory that it was a Hezbollah operation, not an Iranian driven operation. Is that wrong? Because this is a super high ranking person in intelligence who's now retired.
There's been Iranian co-conspirators indicted in this case, So this is the point again, the relationship between Hezbollah and Iran, which is very deep. It's very different than some of the, when Hezbollah does something like that, like it has Iranian support. You can bound it. So look, I'm definitely not painting.
I mean, you're just asserting that when Hezbollah does something big, it must have Iran's support.
I am asserting it, but I'm partially asserting it based on like my years in the U.S. government when I saw intelligence on how this relationship worked, right? So it's more than just me asserting it without any knowledge. It's me asserting it based on things that we've seen. So,
But things you saw not in this specific context.
Right. Not in this specific context. Okay. From what I know about.
So it's an inference about this specific attack drawn from a pattern you observed in other contexts.
Yes.
And I, the reason I want to dwell on that is because, I mean, I think you'd agree the American narrative about Iran is distorted, right?
Yeah.
And it is the kind of thing that helps get us into war. When this happens and they do the polls and you say, how many Americans support military retaliation, and people who watch not just Fox, but honestly, CNN, MSNBC are going to have a distorted view of Iran. And that's why every time we attribute something to Iran that was done by a proxy, I want to make sure we actually know that Iran, did it. And I just think you have to exercise great care here, but certainly that it could well be that they gave the order. I'm not sure we know, but it was a horrible thing that happened.
But the thing is, so here's the challenge, right? The challenge is there's a standard. You have to figure out what that standard is, right? It's not a legal, in my opinion, it shouldn't be the legal standard, right? It shouldn't be beyond a reasonable doubt. Because if the standard is too low, and you have the wrong people using it, then you end up with Mike Pompeo blaming Iran for a Taliban attack a couple weeks ago in Afghanistan, which clearly had like nothing to do with Iran and Taliban.
Right.
If the standard is too high, then you give a ton of space for actors like Iran to use this type of sort of covert behavior. And it's not just the Iranians, it's the Russians, it's others, it's little green men in Ukraine. Right. And you let them get away with all these things without any kind of a pushback because because it's very hard to find that, you know, needle in a haystack. Here's the exact, you know, for this event, here's the exact thing that proves it precisely. And so there has to be some judgment in there on where that appropriate middle ground is. And it depends on a case by case basis. So like I said, if you're going to tell me that the Taliban conducted this attack 2 weeks ago, against Americans in Afghanistan, you better show me some really solid proof. But you're going to tell me somebody like blew some holes in tankers in the UAE or Saudi Arabia. Like, yeah, I want evidence, but my standard is lower because it is in character with the general behavior and capabilities and everything I know. And so about the way Iran operates. And so I think that's got to be an important part of how we judge this.
I'm not raising questions about your inference there. I mean, it seems to me we're still below kind of the 95% threshold, which is an important threshold. It means 1 in 20 times it's going to turn out you have a Gulf of talking situation, you know, but, but that aside, I'm just talking about the fact that it seems to me that in the region, the behavior in the region that we hear so much about is various countries struggling for power. Often the things that we find that we deem offensive and egregious, like I think a lot of us consider the Saudi intervention in Yemen egregious, Saudi Arabia probably considers it defensive. I mean, the way I understand it is Saudi Arabia, in the beginning, there wasn't much Iranian involvement in the Houthi thing.
Yeah.
And the Saudis saw more than was there, got freaked out, got involved. The Houthis weren't particularly even anti-Saudi probably at that point, at least not in a militant way. But so Saudis overreading Iranian involvement intentions there led them to freak out and create a mess. But I give Saudi Arabia this much. They probably think of this as a defensive operation. And I'm just saying that the various things we talk about Iran doing in the region are probably, you know, they tend to fall in the same category. And
yeah, I mean, look, so on the Saudi case, the Houthis were launching missiles into Saudi Arabia in like 14-15. But you're right. I mean, the Saudi reaction, overreaction, created an Iranian –
Well, also, there had been Saudi involvement in Yemen before the missiles started coming, right?
Yeah. I mean,
that's my point.
Well, the Saudis really got involved in Yemen in 2015, in March 2015.
Well,
the big
aerial attack. But my sense is that they started screwing around there earlier.
Oh, they've always been there.
Yeah.
Because they view Yemen as sort of their, it's almost like their backyard.
Right.
They view vulnerability of what can come out of there. All these countries, you're right that we do that, you know, the rules of the Middle East are pretty ugly and all these countries are operating in some pretty nasty ways. You know, and maybe you're right. Maybe the argument is purely, but some of them are our partners and allies and don't attack us and others are not and do attack us. And so you have to think about that, in terms of how you approach it, but you also can't apply a double standard that's just completely out of whack, which is why I think we should be pressing the Saudis on Yemen and we should be using the tools we have available to us on punishing them for Khashoggi. You know, and we should be using, if you have a partner or an ally who's doing things wrong, you have certain kinds of influence with them, you should use it. And we could do that with the Israelis too. And we should be pressing the Israelis on a two-state solution and all kinds of other things they do that are problematic.
But we're not, but that's not even my main point. My main point is we are depicting Iran as sui generis. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's just these are cliches. The world's leading sponsor of terrorism, the most destabilizing country in the region. Look, the most destabilizing country in the region is the U.S. over the last 20 years. But this gets back to the problem that the Trump administration, when Iran, if Iran ever comes back to the table, the Trump administration wants them to do all of this stuff beyond the nuclear deal entirely. Like, they don't think they should be allowed to have the kind of just regular missiles everyone else has. They don't think that when the regime in Saudi Arabia, the regime in Syria, which for better or worse is the regime, was the regime, says to Iran, can you come into our country? And Iran comes into their country.
Yeah.
Iran considers that like, that's the way the world works, right? An ally invites you into your country. You put your troops there. Well, not only does Trump like want them out, but the Israelis regularly kill them in violation of international law, and nobody says anything. And Iran just lives with it, right?
Well, I mean, on the other hand, the Assad regime is primarily responsible for, you know, the murder of most of the people who have died in a war in Syria.
Well, of course, if you want to get into that argument, my own view is it was a mistake for us and our allies to turn what would have been a brutally suppressed insurrection into a full-blown civil war by flooding the area with weapons. But that aside, my point is just that we purport to respect national sovereignty, and in general, it's not a big deal. Look, we have tons of atrocious allies who sponsor death squads. And if they invite our troops in, we're there. Okay. But if Iran has an ally that does horrible things and they invite Iranian troops in, we're like, okay, well, Israel will kill them on a regular basis in acts of transborder aggression, and we will demand that they leave. And I'm just saying, you know, from Iran's point of view, these are non-starters. None of this is to say anything at all favorable about the Assad regime any more than I'd say favorable things about the various brutal regimes we've supported. It's just to say there's a hugely distorted picture being drawn for the American public. And that, as much as anything, is what is going to get us into war.
Yeah. Oh, look. So I think a lot of that is fair. I wouldn't agree with some of the characterizations, but I do agree with you that, look, Iran is a country ultimately driven by its interests, its behaviors, the tools that it uses are, you know, there's a reason it uses all these sort of asymmetric tools and it arms all these militias and all these groups and uses missiles. It's because those are the tools that work best for it, because it's totally outgunned and outnumbered at the sort of traditional conventional warfare capability. It'd be just really stupid of them to try to build an aircraft carrier to compete with us. That'd be like a very dumb way for them to fight.
Right.
And so this is why they use all these things. And, you know, I do think that ultimately, you know, if you're going to make progress with Iran, you're going to need to not just focus on the nuclear question, but you're going to need to look at negotiating some of these other elements.
But again, why?
Why should we negotiate?
Why are we asking Iran not to behave the way other countries in the region?
No. Negotiate. That's not asking not to behave. That's saying you need to actually cut diplomatic deals that result in de-escalation all sides.
But do we need to say to them, you can't have just regular ballistic missiles that other countries have? You can't have your troops in a neighbor that is an ally of yours and which you see as a defensive buffer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which if you describe that in the abstract, of course a country is allowed to do that. Why are we not going to allow Iran to do it?
Okay, so I think that's not what I am saying. You look at what's happening in the Middle East. You're forcing me to pull back a little bit. But like fundamentally, like what is happening in the Middle East? You've had all these states collapse, right? You've created these big vacuums. And then all the different actors, you know, basically that was the collapse of these states was in some ways the embers of the fire. And then you have all these different actors, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, Iran, all worried about losing influence in these places. And so they all start dumping weapons and people and sort of causing the place to blow up and turn these small civil wars into big civil wars. It wasn't us in Syria. It was partially us in Syria. And then like, it was also partially the Iranians. It was partially the Saudis.
Right, but we were the ones who aspired to overthrow a government in Syria. They didn't want that. I mean, that's what destabilization is, right? Is when you go into a country that's not yours and put a bunch of weapons in there and try to overthrow the government. Again, it's a horrible government, but if we're just talking kind of clinically about destabilization, overthrowing a government is what's destabilizing. Iran wasn't trying to do that.
Right, but if Iran had not intervened, then the government would have been overthrown even without our influence. I mean, the Iranians were in there early, as were earlier than we were, frankly. And so, and the Iranians have put like 100,000 troops in there from all over the world, basically these Shia mercenaries from like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq. You know, nobody's behaved well. I'm still getting at the point of this is not a question of fault, okay? The reality is the combination of these vacuums combined with all the actors then jumping into them has turned small civil wars into horrible big civil wars that have all kinds of profound effects beyond just the countries themselves, with refugee flows, terrorist safe havens, all the things that you can tie directly to things like Brexit and Donald Trump. I mean, it's not a direct line, but there's an influence there. There's no question. And so if we have an interest in tamping all that down, we need to get both sides. We need to get the Iranians and we need to get the Saudis to sort of tamp it down. And how do you do that? And everybody else too. The Iranians and the Saudis are the two biggest players. And how do you do that? Well, traditionally with Iran, we have a pretty ugly relationship. So we're going to need to negotiate with them, but we're also going to need to be able to deter some of these things and demonstrate that it's a cost. And for the Saudis, while we have a better historic relationship, the answer needs to be not the blank check that, you know, Donald Trump is giving them, but sort of saying like, look, we'll have your back on things that we agree with you on, but we're also like, we expect a lot more of you. And this is, if you want our relationship, like you have to pull back here and there. And so it's a combination of using the tools that we have with the Iranians, with the Saudis, and with everybody else in the region to try to get them all to pull back a little bit and ultimately negotiate over their interests. Cause like, if you look at their interests, you know, for example, take Syria and Yemen, right? In Yemen is really important to the Saudis, right? It's not that important to the Iranians. The Iranians are now, they're more in Yemen than they were in the beginning. They're not as much there as the Saudis. They're there to mess with the Saudis, right? Meanwhile, Syria for the Iranians is hugely important. It's like how they project power into the Levant. It's not that big for the Saudis. So you could see a political deal there. You could see a deal where Iran says, we're going to pull all our stuff out of Yemen and you're going to pull all your stuff out of Syria. You can see different kinds of arrangements.
Yeah, I mean, Israel also has issues with their presence in Syria, but go ahead.
Absolutely, in the south. Well, you'd have to figure out a deal around that too. But the point being, I'm not arguing for, you know, villainize the Iranians, support the Saudis. I am arguing for the reality of today. We have a long history of, we have ways we can influence these players based on their history of our relationships with them. We need to try to use those to try to do something so at least tamp down what's been really like 10 years of just disaster in the Middle East. And a disaster that we had a large part in creating.
I was going to say, I mean, we had a much bigger role than Iran. And I would say probably our allies did too. But certainly, I mean, look at countries that imploded. Iraq, Libya, Syria. We played a significant, we and or our allies played a significant role in all of those and were much more the initiators, I would say, certainly in two of the three. And I would say, in the case of Syria, I mean, if the Iranians were there early, okay. But again, remember what they were doing was supporting an existing government that, that was kind of becoming, visibly horrible at that time because it was brutal and its suppression of an insurrection.
Yeah.
But from Iran's point of view, it's an ally. It's a buffer state.
It was brutal. Like, let's be clear. It was brutal in its suppression of what started as peace.
Oh, sure. It's a brutally repressive, regime. And to the extent that it was challenged, the quantity of the brutal repression grew, as it would in, say, Egypt, which has shown another ally of ours that has shown that it is brutally repressive, as it probably would in Saudi Arabia if it had a serious challenge. I just want to emphasize again, we are the ones who helped amp up the challenge that wound up getting tons of people killed and creating tons of refugees. If you don't send all those weapons into Syria, it doesn't happen. I admit you're leaving a brutal regime in power, but there's a lot less actual brutality if you don't turn something into a civil war. Now,
I could, my view there is, I think you're right that like our policy in Syria was a disaster. I was always of the view, or in retrospect, I'm of the view that you should have either intervened in a way that was decisive, which we could have done if we wanted to, or not intervened at all. But doing like the halfway measure was the worst of all worlds, creating exactly the scenario you're talking about.
And I'd say, you know, when you describe the thing as you're doing, like, let's work to tame things down, I'm fine, because that's like a symmetrical view of things.
Yep.
I'm just saying that the demands the Trump administration is making of Iran are wildly asymmetrical and are tied into an asymmetrical narrative that I think prevails not just on Fox News, but in little ways on CNN, MSNBC, New York Times, Washington Post. Yep. I think too much of the Iran hawk rhetoric is just kind of uncritically absorbed into our discourse.
Yeah, and any negotiated deal, I mean, it's not the Pompeo's 12 Looney Tune points, which are these extreme, Iran must disarm and surrender and walk away. It's going to have to be a negotiation. But I'll just say on this front, like, I actually think Iraq now in some ways has become, I mean, it's kind of crazy to say, but the positive model, at least how things are going now, in that Iran has influence in Iraq through its various political relationships. The U.S. has influence in Iraq through its various political relationships, and both of them have military presences of different forms. The Saudis and the Arab states have started to open up, embassies in Iraq and try to build a better relationship. There's a lot of competition going on, but it's happening without guns. And I think that, you know, if that's where we go towards, that's like a better place to be. And keeping it at that level is really what we want. You know, competition amongst different players in the region for the purposes of influence is something that's going to happen. But if it can happen without, you know, people dying and violence on all sides, that's just much better. So, you know, who
I'm in
knew?
Favor of that.
Yeah.
Okay. So thank you. Anything else you want to say?
No, that was great. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Let's mention a couple of other works you were involved in. One is called A Realistic Path for Progress on Iran, 12 Guiding Principles to Achieve U.S. Policy Goals. That and the next thing I'm going to mention are done by you and some of your collaborators at the Center for New American Security. Escalation or Negotiation, Conclusions of a Tabletop Exercise on the Future of U.S.-Iran Relations. The substance of both of these, to some extent, was brought into our conversation, even though we didn't talk about them specifically. But the big piece of yours and yours alone is what a war with Iran would look like in foreign affairs. And where can people find your stuff? You tweet. What's your tweet? And I should say you've had some very good threads on Twitter amid this kind of – amid the action that's been, for better or worse, going on here with Iran. Is it just your name? What is it?
Yeah, it's Ilan, I-L-A-N, Goldenberg.
Okay.
So Ilan, yeah.
And I'm at Robert Reiter, W-R-I-G-H-T-E-R. Any place else that people can find your stuff?
Center for New American Security is probably the best place to go, or Google me. Yep.
Okay. Thanks so much, Ilan. It was a great conversation.
Bye. Thanks. It was fun.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.